Hey everyone, and welcome to Unconventional Wellness Radio, a powerful and inspiring podcast set to revolutionize and disrupt healthcare. It's time to put you in the driver's seat and be the force of change necessary for the lifestyle you've always wanted. Hey everyone, this is Frank from Unconventional Wellness Radio, and I have the special pleasure and privilege of being able to bring my new friend, Dr. Edwin McDonald, on the call today. Dr. Edwin McDonald is a board-certified gastroenterologist. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and he, of course, also sees patients there. And he's also the Associate Director of Human Nutrition at the University of Chicago. And I had the great pleasure of meeting Dr. McDonald very recently, a matter of fact, here in the Asheville area, at the Healthy Eating and Conference Practice, which was held by an organization called ASAP, which is a great organization. It's a nonprofit trying to bring about awareness of sustainable agriculture. And they had this conference where they had folks who are just getting started with their medical careers, and then folks like Dr. McDonald who have been practicing for a while. But they're doing very innovative and very cool things with nutrition, and they're bringing in all of these other aspects of wellness. And so, Dr. McDonald, it's a pleasure to have you on the call tonight.
Hey, what's up, Frank? I'm honored to be here. I really appreciate everything that you're doing. So thanks for having me on the show, man.
Absolutely. So one of the things that captivated us was your story, that you're just a natural storyteller, and I really want to share you with everybody out there in the unconventional wellness world about just how brilliant the journey has been for you leading up to, you know, your eventual deciding to go to medical school. But you really have this really great history of culinary arts. If you don't mind, why don't you go ahead and just kind of tell us a bit of that story of how you got started with that?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really an interesting story about how I got into medicine. So, you know, originally what inspired me to get into medicine was actually my great-grandfather, who I never met before, because he passed away before I was born, like shortly before I was born. So I'm actually Edwin McDonald IV. So I'm the fourth generation of, you know, men in my family with that name, and my son is the fifth. But my great-grandfather was actually a physician. So I would hear these stories about, like, how amazing this guy was, and I have his name, but I never met him. So I always felt like I was, you know, living in that shadow. So he was born in, like, I don't know, 1893 something like that. And his father was actually born a slave. So he was born, like, before, you know, slavery ended. He was just a baby at that time.
Wow, okay.
But my great-grandfather ended up going to medical school at Northwestern, which I didn't really know until I was actually a medical student at Northwestern. Like, I thought he went to medical school somewhere else, and I literally found out when I was a medical student, coincidentally, at Northwestern.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, my great-grandfather, it's funny, he was a pediatrician here in Chicago. So at that time, African-Americans can only go to certain hospitals due to, you know, the way the world was at that time.
Of course. So, yeah, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, but that was, I mean, that was the reality of it. So he was a pediatrician in a hospital. That was the only hospital in Chicago that would see African Americans. And as a result, a lot of my patients who are, like, in their 90s now were actually his patients.
How cool is that, right?
Yeah.
Like, you never even knew that you were going to follow in his footsteps.
No, and we actually have the same patients to some degree.
That's
so
cool.
I have at least maybe 15 patients that have my great-grandfather as their patients. Yeah. So I got into, that's how I originally got interested in medicine. And, you know, subsequently I, you know, went to medical school and all that good stuff. But I got into nutrition primarily. It really started when I was, you know, younger. I always enjoyed cooking. So my grandmother's taught me how to cook and everything. When I was younger, my mom was off in the hospital frequently. So I had to be the person that cooked for the family. So one of my grandmothers, and, you know, these are like matriarchs of the family. So they really sat me aside, gave me cookbooks. You know, I'm like 10 years old, flipping through the joy of cooking, trying to find recipes for the family, and I loved it. So I ended up becoming a halfway decent cook. And then fast forward to my teenage years, I started working at McDonald's. I actually became a manager at McDonald's. So when I was working there, I would see these families who were coming to McDonald's, you know, every day for dinner, or some people come in every morning for breakfast. And, I just thought something was odd about that. I don't really have the medical terminology to express what I thought was odd about it, but something just didn't really seem right about people going to McDonald's every single day, all the time.
Yeah.
So I started cooking things for them that wasn't on the menu. So, you know, I'll make omelets in the morning. Like, you can't get, you know, an omelet at McDonald's. But I would take the Canadian bacon from the Egg McMuffins and the onions from the Big Mac and the eggs from the Egg McMuffins and, you know, put them all on the skillet and on the grill and make omelets out of it. And it got to the point where my McDonald's had a secret menu.
So you became like the Iron Chef of McDonald's.
Yeah, you know, just for one, you shouldn't put a 16-year-old in charge of anything.
This is true.
And that's what you get. You get secret menus at McDonald's when the 16-year-old is running the show. But, you know, for whatever reason, people enjoyed it. And, you know, seeing the fact that people enjoyed what I was doing really showed me how important cooking was outside of my own home. You know, cooking for your family is one thing, but then when you start cooking for other people and really seeing how the positive impact that can have on somebody outside of people who actually like you or know you, it felt good. And that's something that I carried with, you know, throughout undergrad and subsequently medical school. Now, when I got into medical school, you start learning about disease. You know, for the most part in undergrad and high school, you don't really learn about your disease and like what goes wrong with the human body and why. So even though I had this pre-med curriculum, that was all science classes. It wasn't actually learning about what happens to people and why things happen to people. So medical school was my first, you know, exposure to some of those concepts. And I remember being in some of those lectures, sitting in front of the class, and the lecturers would say, you know, we have a talk on diabetes, and they're like, well, diabetes, most of the reason why people have diabetes, type 2 diabetes in the United States, is because of the foods that we eat. High blood pressure, you know, people in the United States eat too much sodium. Heart disease, people eat, you know, foods that are too high in cholesterol. So I would raise my hand after all those lectures and ask the lecturer, well, what should we be eating? And there would be a blank face, a blank stare on their face, and no one would have a response. They would just say, well, we need to eat right. But no one would actually define what eating right was. And I would sit in the front of the class, and a lot of these conditions disproportionately affect African-Americans. And for me as an African-American, you know, I'm asking the question, not only as a physician, but also for myself. Like, I don't want to get diabetes.
Sure, sure.
I don't want to have high blood pressure. So, you know, there was definitely a desire to help others, but there was also, you know, I'm asking the question out of self-preservation to some degree.
Absolutely.
And no one would give me an answer. And matter of fact, people would get annoyed. Like, why are you asking this question? So, you know, at medical school, it just said these were the problems, but we didn't really learn about solutions. I mean, we learned about pharmacology, what medications to give for high blood pressure. I mean, I can tell you a dozen medications for high blood pressure, but your average doctor probably couldn't tell you a dozen foods that can help out with high blood pressure. So that's something that carry on that I took when I went to become a resident. And as a resident, when I started having my own clinic, I had a clinic at the Jesse Brown VA where I had the privilege of taking care of the veterans. And like I told you at the conference and everyone at the conference, I really appreciated taking care of the vets. If I had to pick out that one of the most important parts of my training, probably my exposure to the veterans and, you know, being able to provide care for them. So it was an amazing experience to be able to hang out with the World War II veterans, the Korean War veterans, and the Vietnam veterans. Most of the patients at that time were Vietnam veterans. And then at that time, some of the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, you know, I saw the first wave of people coming back. Yeah. So, you know, people were able to share their experiences about what's really
you're
going on.
You're actually talking to one of those on the podcast right now.
Yeah.
I was an Iraq war veteran, so.
So, you know, for me, I have nothing but the utmost respect and appreciation for the veterans. And then I also really appreciated hearing their stories and perspectives because, you know, what we see on the news and what really goes down, these aren't necessarily one and the same. And
yeah.
You don't really know that until you have the opportunity to talk to somebody about that. So for me, you know, it was humbling, but I learned a lot. And
you
I
know,
had one better.
It's one of those experiences that you really, well, first of all, we thank you. You know, as a veteran community, we love our physicians. And so if I may just tell you, we thank you for your service as well. And that there really is, like, just value in hanging out with the veteran community because there's just so many stories. You know, it's like we come from all corners of the United States, and to be able to descend with that common thread of serving, you know, and then just the networking that goes along with that is just, it's life-changing, so.
And on a side note, for your listeners, if you guys have any politicians that threaten to take funding away from the VA hospital and does not want to give the VA hospital the funding it needs, like, those politicians are terrible, and you should not support them.
We concur, yep.
And, you know, you can quote me on that and call me over Chicago Hospital and tell them I said it. I don't care. I stand
yeah, you spell that,
that
name, unlike McDonald's, you have to add an A to it. So it's M-A-C, so. But you'll still be able to find it. But, yeah, no, thank you for that.
So I had one veteran in particular, and, I talked about his story at the conference. So I'm a young intern. I have my clinic, and, you know, I came into medicine with a certain degree of idealism. I'm very idealistic, and I want to be this great doctor, and I really want to help people. And I see this patient for the first time. I look over his chart, get his history, and I see all the notes from other doctors. And he had, you know, all the common diseases that affect Americans. So diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, had a mild stroke in the past, you know, mild heart attack in the past, also had fatty liver disease. He's probably 100, 150 pounds overweight. Mm. And he also recently got divorced because he had erectile dysfunction. So with all the stuff he had going on as far as health issues that led to erectile dysfunction, which led to a divorce. And then plus, you know, he had some depression and, you know, a whole bunch of things going on. And I looked through his chart. Every time he would come to the doctor, his blood pressure would be a little bit elevated. And one of my colleagues would just add on another blood pressure medication or increase the dose of blood pressure medication.
Mm.
If he came in, blood sugar would be a little bit higher, and, you know, every person, all they would do is add another medication on or increase his insulin. And insulin actually promotes weight gain. So as his insulin, as his insulin dose was increasing, his weight was simultaneously increasing with it. He would have a heart attack, you know, they just give him aspirin, or he would go from a baby aspirin to a full dose aspirin, and that was the response to heart attacks.
And if I may, I just wanted, for the listeners, for the benefit of the listeners, if I may, Dr. McDonald, I wanted to let you guys know what there's a description of that. I'm a physician assistant. I didn't necessarily say that, but you guys probably know that from listening to my other podcast, but that's something that we call polypharmacy. And that is a way that a lot of Americans these days are being managed, is that it's like if one blood pressure medication isn't working, there is a complementary blood pressure medication that has been created, different class of medications, but then you end up running into patients that are on 5, 6, 7 medications to handle all of these conditions that Dr. McDonald was talking about. And then you can run into a slew of possible side effects that may or may not be going on. You know, like one of the most typical side effects of somebody, like in the veteran community, if they're on an antidepressant, there's going to be erectile dysfunction. And you have to watch out for some of the medications that folks are on commonly, because a lot of folks just will tack these medications on. They do a quick little scrub, but then they're on 5 or 6 medications, which I don't know if anybody really likes to do that. But that's the concept of polypharmacy, if that's okay that I added that.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And then, you know, for me as a physician, I don't want to downplay the need for medications, because in many situations, people need medication.
Mm-hmm.
And medications have been well studied to, you know, have some positive benefits for
Absolutely.
Certain scenarios. But when you use medications without addressing the underlying problem, I think it's like, you know, I don't want to say the elephant in the room, but for lack of a better analogy, like we're ignoring the obvious in certain situations.
Agreed.
And in his situation, no one addressed what he was eating. And for me, I felt like it was there was obviously an issue or obviously something that we should talk about. But when I looked through all the notes, I didn't see any comment on what he was eating. I didn't see any, you know, dietitian notes, which unfortunately in America, it's actually hard to sit down with a dietitian. Most insurance companies don't pay for dietitians, and Medicare, Medicaid, you know, good luck. You have to, you know, have really bad diabetes to be able to sit down with a dietitian.
Sure.
And even still, they may not cover everything. So it's just like, why do you have to wait till you have diabetes in order to see a dietitian? Like, we should see dietitians so we won't get diabetes.
Yeah, there's no proactivity there. Yeah.
Right. That's a whole separate conversation. So I sat down and I asked him a simple question. I'm like, hey, man, you know, so I see you have all these diseases that stem from diet. Like, what are you eating? And he just told me hot dogs. And, you know, I didn't think he meant hot dogs for every meal. So I asked him, I'm like, well, what are you doing for breakfast? And, you know, he calmly said hot dogs. And then I'm like, well, what are you doing for lunch? And he seemed a little bit more annoyed. I could hear it in his voice, a little bit of anger. And he's just like, hot dogs. And then I asked him again. I'm like, okay, well, what are you doing for dinner? Now, at this point, I could tell he was visibly annoyed. Like, he stood up. He looked like he was going to walk out. And I'm just like, just work with me, man. And then he said hot dogs again. So, you know, I realized he was really just eating hot dogs every single meal. And these weren't even hot dogs with relish on it. There was, like, no vegetables whatsoever. It was just a hot dog. And he didn't even put ketchup on it. It was hot dogs and mustard. Because in Chicago, you know, your Chicago-style dog typically does not have ketchup on it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so he was just...
More of a southern thing, I suppose.
Yeah, I should look up the history of that. But nonetheless, he was just eating hot dogs with mustard. And I told him, I'm like, you can't live on hot dogs. That is not a life-promoting diet. If anything, that is a death-promoting diet.
Sure.
And I realized we had to make some changes. So I gave him a recipe, nothing fancy. At that point in my life, you know, I knew how to cook, but I wasn't a trained chef or anything like that. So I gave him a recipe. I just said, look, man, what vegetables do you like? And he was just like, well, I love broccoli and I love cauliflower. And I'm like, okay, cool. We can work with broccoli and cauliflower. I told him to basically just put some, you know, grab some cauliflower, some broccoli, throw some olive oil on it, a little bit of salt, not too much because you have high blood pressure. Roast it in the oven, put it in 425, roast it for 15, 20 minutes. Get a little bit char on it, not too much. It'll come out delicious. And he said, okay. Wrote down a recipe. We shook hands, and I told him to come back and see me in 3 months. So 3 months later, he comes back. And, I mean, he's like 40, 50 pounds down.
Wow.
He was complaining of dizziness because his blood sugar was going low periodically, and also his blood pressure was a lot lower than what it has been. So I'm looking at this guy. You know, I think the guy has cancer or something. I'm like, man, we need to check your prostate. Like, what's going on? Did you get colonoscopy because you lost all this weight all of a sudden? And I'm like, what have you been eating? And he basically was just like, well, I stopped eating the hot dogs. And I just ate the roasted vegetables. I'm like, well, what'd you do for breakfast? And he roasted vegetables lunch, and he got a little bit annoyed. Roasted vegetables dinner, the same thing. So he essentially switched over to a plant-based diet.
Sure.
And, you know, I found that his blood pressure was low. Again, the blood sugars were on the low side. So we had to slowly decrease his insulin. We had to slowly decrease his blood pressure medications. And, you know, being on just broccoli and cauliflower alone, that's not the healthiest diet to be on in the long term. So we had to, you know, add some more plant-based sources of protein and things of that nature and other, you know, a variety of different vegetables. But, you know, nonetheless, he switched over to becoming a vegetarian. And, you know, one thing that stood out to me, he said when he lost all that weight, he noticed that he can wipe his butt easily. Whereas before, when he had so much weight on him, he couldn't really do that. And
sure.
When he lost more weight, he even mentioned that he had an easier time tying his shoes and putting his socks on. Whereas before, you know, he couldn't really put his socks on easily. Like, it was a struggle. He had to have, you know, different tools to help him get his socks on. And just, you know, simple things like being able to wipe himself easily and putting his socks on was his motivation to take things a step further. So, you know, he started riding his bike. He started, you know, walking more and started engaging in more physical activity. And, you know, subsequently, as a result, he started feeling better. His depression got a little bit better. His erectile dysfunction got better. He started dating. And, you know, what I took away from that story was this was just all food. This had nothing to do with me as a physician. You know, that there was no, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, the coach of Notre Dame or something. I'm giving him a great speech that inspired him. It wasn't like that. It was just, he just changed his diet. And if anything, he inspired me to talk about this with more patients, because the change I saw him, I'm like, you know, can we replicate this?
Sure.
Can other people do what he did? And I found that, yes, people can, and people want to. We just have to, you know, give people the right guide to do that. So that's why I decided eventually to, after residency, study nutrition and go to culinary school and get certified as a chef. So when I was doing my fellowship in nutrition at the University of Chicago, that fellowship was mostly geared towards clinical nutrition, which is very different than just talking about food. So clinical nutrition is really using like TPN and IV nutrition.
Yeah.
And you know, placing feeding tubes in people's stomachs and stuff like that, and feeding them, and it's really a sick population of patients, but these are people who've had severe injuries, you know, be it from trauma or car crashes, and, you know, a lot of their bowel has been removed, so they can't eat food the regular way, or people who have cancer, and, you know, the cancer is blocking their bowel, so we have to figure out ways to give them so they can survive, you know, as they're finishing chemotherapy. So, you know, a really sick population of patients. But that fellowship wasn't teaching me about, you know, how to feed people who have diabetes. It wasn't talking about, like, everyday stuff.
Sure.
So that's why I went to culinary arts school in the evenings and got trained as a chef. And with culinary arts training, you had to actually take a nutrition class. And the crazy thing is, you know, throughout medical school, I didn't have a nutrition class. I had to go to culinary arts school to get my first class in nutrition.
Wow.
And I went to a top-notch medical school. I mean, like, one of the best in the country.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. But that's like the state of healthcare nowadays. And that also explains why, you know, we spend all this money on healthcare. We're number one in the world when it comes to health spending. But in terms of, you know, our actual longevity, I think the United States works like 31st or 33 in the world as far as how long we're actually living, which there's a huge disconnect. Like, we spend all this money, but we don't necessarily get the outcome that we're paying for.
Sure.
And a lot of it has to do with we're missing the simple stuff. And the simple stuff is important. So, yes, you know, you can get the craziest complex surgery here. You can come see me for colonoscopies, and I can take out polyps and, you know, possibly remove cancers and, you know, all these problems. But when it comes to, you know, the foundation for preventing some of these problems, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the United States. And, you know, doctors play a role, but there's a lot of stuff that can be done outside of the hospital. And, you know, the kitchen is just as important. I think the kitchen is probably as important as the medicine cabinet.
I just thank you so much for sharing that, by the way. It's now been my probably second time, maybe third time hearing that story, and it just gets better every time I hear it. Seems like I just get so many more nuggets out of it. So thank you so much for sharing that, Dr. McDonald. And I think I echo exactly what you're saying, and what this entire, you know, what this entire concept of unconventional wellness is really centered around is still the patient-provider relationship. There is still massive value in that,
yeah.
And I think that we both can say that we appreciate the fact that we live in a society where we do have major advancements in medical care. I mean, people are getting cured from different types of cancers all the time all around the world. I mean, we might be on the cusp of actually understanding. I mean, we now live in a world where we can treat hepatitis C. We never thought about that when I was going through PA school and you were probably going through medical school.
Yeah.
That was it. We were talking about, you know, these folks possibly having to go on the liver transplant list, but now we have a medication that could do it. So amen to the advancements that we have in our medical care. But yes, some of those statistics that came out of the same conference that we attended was, you know, it's unbelievable how 80% of Americans have a preventable disease. Like, we don't die from tuberculosis anymore in this country.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we'll get cases of it and stuff like that, but by and far, these things have been treated, and we thankfully have a society free of them.
Yeah.
But of that, 80% of Americans, you know, depending upon, I guess, the source that you're looking at, I've seen it as high as $2 trillion in America on medical costs to actually manage those 80% of Americans who have a preventable disease. And so there's a problem here. And I think that the biggest disconnect starts with the choices that we as the patients are actually making. And so we need to empower our physicians, I think, to let them understand that we want this and we need this.
Yeah.
And that I don't care to be seen by a doctor, you know, many times throughout my entire year. I would love to come in, shake a hand, maybe have to do my colonoscopy when I'm 50 and, you know, everything looks good, Mr. Ritz, take care. You know, I would love for it to be like that. But you're absolutely right. I think that we are really losing touch with food. It's becoming far too easy for us to look at a way of saying, I just need this food and I need it fast. We have a very fast food mentality, and I'm not talking about just fast food restaurants. I think I'm talking about, we have this mentality. I mean, Whole Foods has made a massive market for themselves, and they're a multi-billion dollar corporation on the sense that, yes, they sell good food. But the thing is that they also, you know, the reason why they were able to get people into the door was that they were taking their good food and they were making it fast. So you could walk up and say, I want this, I want this, I want this.
Yeah.
They'll put it into a tray and then you're out the door.
Right.
So at least you're eating healthy food. But, yes, it's still a fast food mentality. So,
You know, the funny thing about Whole Foods, we act like Whole Foods is a brand new concept. But if you go back to the 1970s, you know, 50s, 60s, et cetera, like, every grocery store was Whole Foods.
Yep.
Like, it, you know, there wasn't a whole, like, most of the vegetables were organic. If you went to the deli section, you had, you know, people who really worked at a deli section to make food in the deli section. So if anything, Whole Foods is just returning to, you know, simpler days where we just focused on
food. Well, and then one of the other talks that I remember that you had during your discussion with us at the conference was, you know, these food swamps and food deserts, you know.
Yeah.
And so if you wouldn't mind, could you describe a little bit about the food swamps and food desert concept for our listeners?
Yeah. So, you know, food deserts, it's a term that, you know, really became popular in the mid-2000s. And it really describes neighborhoods where there is a lack of access to you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, so grocery stores that contain, you know, fruits and vegetables. So most of these neighborhoods have convenience stores, but not necessarily full-fledged grocery stores. So those are basically called food deserts. And the term actually originated in Scotland. It didn't even originate in the United States, but the United States kind of took it and ran with it. So Chicago, the city in which I live in, definitely have some food deserts, and most of the food deserts are actually in African-American neighborhoods. It's not all of them are all in African-American neighborhoods.
Okay, yep.
So food deserts do not affect everyone equally. However, a lot of rural areas, which they don't really get as much attention as they deserve, are also qualified as food deserts for different reasons. So even though rural areas may have farms and stuff like that, but the food grown on those farms may not actually get to the residents of those areas in many places. So those areas technically can, you know, are considered food deserts. Food swamps is a little bit different concept. If anything, it's more of a realistic concept because, one, if you go to any urban community that's designated a food desert, it's not like you won't see food. There's plenty of fast food joints and, you know, plenty of convenience stores. So in many ways, those areas are swamps, swamps of unhealthy food. And the food swamps, if anything, that's really driving the problem. You know, imagine if you don't have a whole lot of money, yet you're hungry. And when you're driving home from work or walking home from work or taking the train from home from work or just, you know, walking around a neighborhood in general, and you pass, you know, your favorite, you know, barbecue spot, or your favorite chicken joint, or, you know, McDonald's, or whatever, and you have to walk by all these places. And these are, you know, these places serve delicious food. It's not like the food tastes bad. Food is amazing at these places.
Sure.
And it's so easy and so tempting just to walk in there and get, you know, three wings for $2 or instant mm-hmm. french fries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to be healthy in that scenario. I mean, it takes, like, I hate to say, everyone wants to talk about willpower and self-control. Like, I feel like these concepts are unfair to some degree because it's hard out here.
So that's all the time that we have for today's podcast. But please make sure that you hit that subscribe button because we're going to be bringing you part two of the interview with Dr. Edwin McDonald as we dive into local regional food and give you some juicy tidbits on how you can start making better choices and live a life of unconventional wellness. So please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or whatever you're listening to us through so you can always receive this great content as soon as we make it. So subscribe right now. And here's to your good health.